It is 7:31, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Marina Skomanich, who is with Seattle Audubon, and Wendy Dyson, who is with the Community Alliance for Global Justice. And we're going to be talking about CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Marina and Wendy, thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thanks very much, Mike.
Let's start out with the basics and tell people what is CAFTA.
So CAFTA is the Central America Free Trade Agreement. It's an expansion of NAFTA to Central America. Now, NAFTA, this isn't going to be a test for your listeners, but I bet many of them will remember NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Agreement, agreement between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, which allowed business interests to have much easier trading opportunities between the two countries, but also establish a whole pile of other provisions that affect workers' rights, the environment, public health. So NAFTA was passed by Congress very contentiously in 1994, and now 10 years later, they're trying to expand NAFTA to Central America, and that's the CAFTA agreement, which is right now in Congress.
So is it exactly the same thing as NAFTA, or are there differences?
Well, it's about 95% the same, and that's the real problem for us. NAFTA, after the last 10 years, we found we had a lot of problems with it, not only on the side of workers. That's not something that I can completely speak to as an environmentalist, but there were big promises about how NAFTA was going to deliver a lot of jobs to America and to Washington State that hasn't come out. In fact, I think there's 30,000 jobs lost in the state. That's not my area of expertise, so I may be wrong there, but I know there was a net loss of jobs in Washington State. In addition, though, NAFTA was going to ensure that the environment between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico got better, that we'd have better laws in place, we'd have better conditions. And in fact, what we found in Mexico is we've had almost a doubling of the deforest rate under NAFTA, directly caused by NAFTA, because NAFTA flooded Mexico with very cheap corn products and other agricultural commodities, driving the farmers off the land. And that's something that Wendy can speak to a little bit more.
Yeah, NAFTA made a lot of really big promises to the ag community, both in the United States as well as in Mexico. But now they've done the 10-year study, and I was just reading the Economic Policy Institute's brief for farmers, and some of the statistics that came out of 10 years after NAFTA is for U.S. small farms, any small farm that has an annual income of under $100,000, our U.S. small farms are disappearing at a rate 6 times faster under NAFTA than they were before NAFTA. In addition, you know, U.S. farm net incomes fell by 10% under the years of NAFTA. And that is accounting, you know, if you were to adjust and take out all the government subsidies that the U.S. government's provided to farmers, then U.S. farm net incomes actually fallen by 23%. So it's huge. And in addition, you know, a lot of the promises under NAFTA were that it would improve our trade situation. But the reality is that our imports have grown while our exports have fallen. So essentially what that comes out to is a greater U.S. trade deficit, which is a worse situation, particularly for small U.S. farmers. And then on the Mexican side, it's been even worse. As U.S. products have flooded to Mexican markets, there's been 1.5 million farmers, like Marina said, who've been forced off their land under NAFTA because they just can't compete with the flood of big agro-corporate products flooding their markets.
So there's one more thing to add to that, and this is a little bit of a sort of a what would you call a sleeper issue for many Americans. But under NAFTA, we've had over 40 lawsuits against legitimate laws that we have in the United States, primarily environmental laws, but also some public health and other laws. These are lawsuits brought by corporations against our government because we've passed laws that cut into their profits. So I want to be really clear. In 1972, when we banned DDT because it was killing off the bald eagle and other really beautiful, important birds in the United States and also threatening our water supply, when we banned DDT, we didn't have to turn around and pay the corporations that were producing DDT. But today, under NAFTA, the United States government is being sued because in the state of California, they phased out a toxic chemical that was poisoning some of their about 20 different water sources, drinking water sources. And the Canadian company that manufactures that chemical said, well, we'll stop selling you the chemical, but you have to pay us $970 million. So there's currently a lawsuit against us for $970 million so that we can have the privilege of having drinking water that's free of toxic chemicals. At least that's in the case of California. But again, there are 39 other similar lawsuits that are pending right now. And we think that this is a terrible, terrible threat, not only to drinking water, but to our ability to regulate the quality of our life, the quality of our drinking water, to make sure that we live in an environment that's clean and safe for us.
So this sounds very similar to what the WTO is doing, where it overrides the laws passed by local municipalities like our cities, our counties, our states, and just totally tossing those out and to instead benefit these corporations.
Well, that's absolutely right. And in fact, there are two points to make there. The first is that CAFTA, NAFTA, this whole alphabet soup, the WTO, they're all part of the same model. It's a certain model for trade agreements. And I just want to step back and say that I can speak very unequivocally for the environmental community, for the faith social justice community. There's this big coalition of groups here in Washington State fighting CAFTA. We are not against trade. I have never met a person that's against trade, and certainly not in the environmental community. We all want to be able to buy those, efficient, innovative Japanese cars. We believe in trade, and certainly trade is a way to bring about sustainable development around the world. So the issue is not whether you are for or against trade. It's whether this trade model is the right way to develop the global economy. And again, there's more and more of a consensus that it's not the right model. You know, this alphabet soup of agreements, they keep going in the wrong direction. And that's why CAFTA was our opportunity to say, let's reorient. We've seen mistakes under NAFTA. We've seen mistakes under the WTO. Let's take a different track. And the irony of all this is that we're smart enough to do it. You know, the United States, the most affluent, innovative, progressive country in the world, we have the ability to think through a good trade agreement that'll work not only for us, but the people around the world.
Yeah, I remember hearing Lori Wallach, who's a national spokesperson on trade and trade lawyer, speak at the U last fall. And I was so struck by, she studied these agreements for decades, and she made a comment at the U that when she first saw the NAFTA agreement in the early 90s, she was just dumbfounded. I mean, she thought, this can't possibly be a trade agreement. You know, it was nothing compared to the kinds of more fair and equitable trade agreements that we've had with other countries in times past. And I'm a young person, and I'm a newer to activism, and it just struck me that, oh, there's this whole other way that we don't even know about, you know. There are alternatives out there. I'm not an expert in that area, so I can't speak real clearly, but just the message that there is a different way to do this, and that NAFTA and CAFTA are really lost opportunities to try and do something that will really work for both countries, you know, so that we can have really good trade that is going to be a benefit to workers and common people on both sides of the border.
What the environmental community likes to say is, we support the development of new trading systems that take away unfair protectionism, because there's a lot of unfair protectionism around the world that leads to a lot of environmental waste. So we want to bring down some of those tariffs and barriers, but we don't want to do it in such a way that it attacks our basic protections, our environmental protections, because as we very clearly determined in our country, we know that in order to have a functioning economy, a flourishing economy, you have got to guarantee environmental quality, that those two things need each other. And so if we can do it, and we have done it in our country with a balance between our environmental laws and our business laws, we can do that in these trade agreements, and that's really all we're asking for. So, for example, one easy place to start, again, CAFTA is a little bit different than NAFTA, and one thing that it does that is quote-unquote better is it has a provision on the environment. NAFTA completely ignored the environment. So CAFTA has acknowledged, okay, there is an environment out there, and we need to think about it. But having said that, the provision is almost completely not mandatory, the opposite of mandatory, discretionary. So in other words, it asks countries to try to meet their laws, but you don't really have to. There's ways you can get around it. And, oh, by the way, it's really more important for you to do all this economic development stuff. So one thing we would ask, and we think needs to be a part of these agreements, is enforceable environmental standards. And I know the labor community has the same feeling on labor standards. After all, it's not really free trade. It's not efficient trade if what you have is, in one country, international standards being met, both on the environment and labor side, and another country, they're kind of circumventing that. That's not the kind of trade we would think would be fair or efficient. So, in order to have a even playing field in the way that the free trade advocates always say they want, that has to include enforceable labor and environmental standards.
And just to pick up on the labor piece a little bit, I recently I came back from Nicaragua last year, where I was learning about their economic situation there. And we went and, you know, NAFTA or CAFTA is basically, it's missed the whole opportunity to strengthen labor protections down in Central America. It's just bypassed that altogether, where basically CAFTA is saying to the Central American governments, you just need to keep doing what you're doing. That's my understanding of it. And what they're doing, I mean, the governments down there are really struggling to form, and there's a lot of corruption, and the workers are not being protected right now. And so that's just one example of how CAFTA is a complete missed opportunity in terms of helping to protect labor. I remember when I was in Costa Rica and we went to go visit a banana plantation to see what life was like for the banana workers down there, and it was just abominable. I mean, workers basically, you know, the way that they keep their costs really low is workers are put on a 3-month contract. And every 3 months, the banana corporations are allowed to renew and renew and renew. And what that does is it doesn't give them any kind of, they can't get any wage increases because they haven't been working there for, you know, like all of the, basically all of the Central American laws revolve around if you have a worker for longer than 3 months, then you have to meet these certain protections. And so they get around that by saying, okay, well, your contract is only 3 months long, and then it ends. And then you have to start a new one, and then it ends. And then you have to start a new one, and then it ends. And so none of those protections ever get put into place. A CAFTA could be an opportunity, if we really wanted to strengthen labor protections, for the agreement to put those protections in there, and it's that's another opportunity that got missed.
And my understanding is laws that protect workers, protect the environment, local laws and stuff, are labeled by the people that put these agreements together as barriers to trade. Is that true?
Well, overall, that's the philosophy of this trade model. And again, it's sort of, I remember Ralph Nader saying calling it trade uber alles, and that's really not an exaggeration. We're basically in a world, it's his own little world, where anything that you might think about that would make society work better or attend to the needs of the poor or attend to the environment, those are all really basically considered barriers to trade. The trade is what we need to allow it at all costs. So, yeah, laws in Central America, laws in the United States, policies that we take, those are all barriers to trade. That's part of the reason, I don't know if people remember, that the turtles marching at the WTO protest in Seattle. And the reason we were having turtle costumes in the parade is specifically because under the WTO, our Endangered Species Act was determined to be a barrier to trade. So this is our effort in our society to say we care about endangered species around the world. And so we want to make sure if we're going to be importing food, in this case it was shrimp, if we're going to be importing shrimp into the United States, we want to make sure it wasn't harvested in such a way that it harmed the endangered turtles. And the WTO said, no, your interest in those endangered turtles is a barrier to trade. Tough luck, you know, so much for that. So I don't know who can even possibly imagine that, you know, all of us people that care about endangered species, our real aim is to make sure the shrimp farmers in Malaysia don't have a fair break. No, we want them to have a fair break, but we need them to do their harvesting in such a way that it protects turtles if they want the privilege of selling it to us. And again, let's remember that all the Endangered Species Act said was, if you're going to sell product to the United States, you have to harvest it in such a way that it doesn't harm endangered species. You can sell it to anybody else you want, however you want, but if you're going to be selling it to us, then you need to meet the standard. And that's, again, getting back to this whole question of, you know, public choice. People say sovereignty, and that always sounds a little heavy. To me, it's all about public and community choice. This is the way we want to live. These are the values we have. Those values we should be able to ensure are part of our economic system, whether it's our state-level, national, or international economic system. And that's what's being lost with this particular trade model.
Yeah, I would really ask. I mean, again, we're not opposed to trade, but at what cost are we willing to just trade as much as possible? I mean, right now, you know, there's up to 75% unemployment in Nicaragua. Central America is completely impoverished. So, okay, let's bring in a trade agreement and make it even worse. I mean, we've seen what happened under NAFTA. Real wages for Mexicans have fallen under that agreement. National poverty rates have increased under NAFTA. CAFTA is just going to be a continuation of that throughout a region that's already much more impoverished than Mexico was when NAFTA first started. I mean, at what cost are we willing to go? When I was there, the children I was working with in Nicaragua, what I saw, I mean, it was poverty beyond anything that I could possibly comprehend. A year later, I still have trouble comprehending it. So to what extent are we willing to go just to continue this kind of trade that's really only benefiting the 1% of the wealthiest people in Central America and the wealthiest, corporations within the United States? Those are the people that are benefiting under these kinds of agreements. Everyone else, it's a complete lose-lose situation, whether you're a small-scale U.S. farmer, whether you're a rural farmer in Mexico or Central America. I mean, another interesting statistic is that Nicaragua, 44% of the Nicaraguan population are small farmers. 60% of the Guatemalan population are small farmers. What's going to happen to those people when our goods come flooding into their markets? Those small farmers can't compete with U.S. agricultural goods that are subsidized. All of those, not all of those farmers, but a large percent of those farmers, I mean, the 1.5 million Mexican farmers had to move to the cities. The same impact's going to happen down in Central America. Those people are going to go to cities that are already overflowing. They're already, you know, high unemployment rates. So when we talk about barriers to trade, I mean, what are we saying? What is the human cost when we remove all of these barriers to create a playing field that Central Americans simply can't compete with? And frankly, neither can small-scale businesses in the United States or small-scale farmers. I mean, that's the cost. Who's really winning here?
Well, I was going to say we've sort of been dwelling on the bad, or sort of the bad situation we're in, but actually there's a very good and positive story to tell here, which is in the face of this situation, the face of our experience with NAFTA, to some degree with the WTO, there's a growing and broadening coalition of people that are coming out opposed to these agreements, and we're winning. We're slowly but surely we're convincing our representatives that, you know, these, again, trade is great. But these trade deals are not the right way to go. So, for example, we've got a coalition now of about 30 organizations in Western Washington that have been working together for the last 4 months trying to convince our representatives to oppose CAFTA, and we have successfully convinced four of our West Side Democratic reps, Brian Baird, Adam Smith, Rick Larson, and Jim McDermott, to come out against CAFTA. We're still working, and we're hoping you all, the listeners of KXP, can help us with Representative Jay Inslee. He is still undecided on CAFTA, but we really feel that we, all the people of Western Washington, can, and particularly his constituents, of course, can convince him that the right thing to do is to come out opposed to CAFTA. In addition, we're working on our two senators, who also are undecided at this moment. I just want to really quickly mention that CAFTA is actually in play in Congress right now. It was just, as of yesterday, entered into the Senate, and there's a possibility that they may be voting on CAFTA in the next week, certainly in the next few weeks. So now is a really good time for your listeners that are concerned about these issues to get on the horn and call their senators, and if you're in Representative Inslee's district, to call him. I've got some numbers. Can I give those, Mike? Okay, so Senator Murray, for, again, all of you eager beavers that are awake at 7:45 on Saturday morning, you can actually call right now. And let's call this sort of a new version of a pledge drive. Call Senator Murray, call Senator Cantwell, call Representative Inslee, and tell him to oppose CAFTA. Here's Senator Murray's number, 206-553-5545. Senator Cantwell, 206-220-6400. And Representative Inslee, 425-640-0233. And again, they need to hear from all of us. And for those listeners that are listening on the web around the country, because this is now in Congress, you have a role you can play, too, with your senators and your representative. So go ahead, get on the corner and call them, too. Let them know what you think about this trade agreement. There is a better way, and we can find it together.
I just really want to underscore what Marina just said, and that is that there really is some good news in CAFTA. I was blown away when I came back to the States and I found out that we were actually winning the CAFTA fight in the House. We were 40 votes ahead right now in terms of a head count on CAFTA. That's our estimate. And Inslee is, as much as many of us love him, he is one of 10 undecided Democrats across the whole country. So he really needs to hear from us. Our senators really need to hear from us. We can actually make a difference this time. And another thing that Lori Wallach said when I heard her speak at the U last year was that her analysis was that with the failure of the WTO over the last few years, as well as all the opposition that's around CAFTA, in addition to the failure of NAFTA now that the 10-year analysis are out, that her analysis is that if we can stop CAFTA, we can potentially that could potentially be the straw that breaks the camel's back to really start turning these trade agreements around. So I really encourage you to call your senators and call Representative Inslee if he's your representative, call Representative Dix if he's your representative today. If your representatives have already come out, Smith, Larson, Baird, McDermott, call them and thank them. Make sure they stay on that side. We really can win this one, which is, to me, the most exciting news out of everything.
I just want to mention, of course, our representatives and senators are unlikely to be working right now, but you can always call their numbers and leave a message, and that's the important thing to do. So, again, even today is a great time to call.
I want to get back to the reason why these trade agreements turn out so bad. It appears, Wendy, you'd mentioned corporate profits and how large corporations are the ones that really benefit from that. Would that be because it's the large corporations that are fielding the people that are writing this these trade agreements in the first place?
They have tremendous influence. In fact, we think that one of the reasons that Inslee has not come out against CAFTA yet is because of the tremendous pressure he's under from Microsoft. And we know that Bill Gates had a personal meeting with Jay Inslee within the last month or so. And part of what CAFTA is going to do is extend the patent laws, which Microsoft, of course, is interested in. And you know, it's not that Central America is such a big market for Microsoft products because, you know, real wages in Central America are very low. They're not going to be able to afford Microsoft Windows 2005. But it's setting a precedent for what trade agreements are going to look like around the world. And so he's interested in that.
But that's another area where we're on the Fair Trade Coalition side pretty frustrated because our feeling is, okay, there may be legitimate issues about intellectual property standards and computer software piracy, et cetera. So that's great. So let's bring that to the table. But we shouldn't be in a position where we're going to be pushing through CAFTA because it's good for Microsoft and the other software companies when it's so bad for so many other of our interests. Again, there's an opportunity to work these things through so that all the interests are heard. You had asked about why these agreements seem to be so skewed towards corporate values. Well, I'll tell you, even all the way back to the early 90s under the Clinton administration, I can't remember if it was for the NAFTA or WTO agreement, but there was an advisory panel, a national advisory panel to the president on trade in chemicals. And the environmental community had to sue the government. We had to sue the Clinton administration to have a seat at that table. I mean, To me, that's just astonishing that we're actually working on the concept of international trade in chemicals, and yet an environmental voice wasn't even allowed on the panel until we sued. And by the way, we won that lawsuit, so we got on the panel. But, and I don't mean Seattle Audubon personally, but a representative of the environmental community. But that in and of itself tells you why these agreements are going the way they're going. You have a whole several sectors of voices that aren't being brought to the table. And so obviously our interests are not being representatives, and simple fixes, simple orientations are being left out, because even if we're going to think that the people negotiating these agreements have our best interests at heart, for example, you know, they absolutely want to protect the environment, it's clear they do not have the professional background, they do not have the knowledge base to ensure that those interests are well represented in the terms of the agreement.
I mean, some of the other ways that these big corporations are going to benefit is, for example, I mean, one of these things that's allowed them to do is do a lot more outsourcing of jobs. And so the large corporations who can afford to move their plants down to Central America are going to do that, and they're going to be able to do that more easily now. You know, one of the arguments under CAFTA is, oh, well, it's good for Central Americans because it's going to bring them more jobs. Well, the reality is, yeah, there's going to be some new jobs that are going to be created through these manufacturing jobs. But NAFTA has shown that the amount of jobs that are lost through the agricultural community aren't nearly made up for through the few amount of jobs that are gained through the increase in manufacturing jobs. But the people that are benefiting are the corporations that are bringing their jobs down there, hiring that cheap labor, and then turning around and bringing those goods back to the United States to sell at a really high price. I mean, we've all heard this story before. So that's one example of the larger corporations that are going to benefit from this.
Well, we only have a few minutes left. It seems to me one of the other things that is missing from the media coverage and the public debate about this is that these trade agreements are always presented as that one country versus another country. You hear in the paper that United States needs to go up against France to bring back these lost sales or potential sales or whatever. But the reality is, to my understanding, is that it's these corporations that say, oh, we've lost money because of these restrictions. They go to, let's say a Boeing goes to the U.S. representatives. The U.S. representatives then go to bat against, let's say, European Union or whatever, extract the money out. And then that money goes into Boeing from the citizens in the European Union. And, of course, the reverse is true when it goes against us as well. So it's always presented that it's like a country versus a country when, in fact, it's mm-hmm. really corporations that are, in fact, reaping the benefits from this, and it's the citizens of the different countries that are being having the funds extracted directly from them.
That's right. Or more generally, it's the corporations and maybe you could say large producers who are winning, and the citizens, or even from the consumer perspective where you're losing. It's always claimed that, you know, because of these trade agreements, we get cheaper products. Well, it depends on how you want to account for cheaper, because you may pay less at the store, but then if you're in a position where your environment's dirty, or your brother who's working at the union is getting less money, you're paying that way. You can't have access to affordable medicine. You're paying that way. And so overall, the effect, particularly on the general citizen, is worse. And I agree with you. One of the ironies is that in this fight on these trade agreements, it's from the perspective of the fair trade community, it's not like it's the U.S. against Central America. In fact, it's civil society in the U.S. coupled to civil society in Central America fighting against, really, frankly, corporate interests in the United States and the small numbers of corporate interests in Central America. And that's another point to make about this, is globalization is really a term that can mean lots of things to different people. What we're really arguing against here is corporate-driven globalization. But on the other hand, we've got civil society globalization, which has been a wonderful to be a part of. So 10 years ago when we were, or a little bit more, when we were starting to worry about these trade agreements, the environmental community we were talking to ourselves in the United States. Today we've got connections with the environmental community in Central America. We've got strong actions on the part of environmentalists in India and Brazil. It's really exciting to see that internationally we're working together.
Oh, and the same thing is happening on the worker side of the equation. And last fall, we brought up union or labor organizers from Central America to speak about the impacts of, well, from Mexico, the impacts of NAFTA, and then the Central American labor union people were speaking about, you know, the impacts they're already feeling from our big corporations going down there and taking away their labor rights and their fear about what's going to happen under CAFTA. So it's really workers uniting with workers across borders to stop this agreement.
All right. Very quickly, where can people turn for more information on this?
Well, one of the best websites nationally is a citizen, public citizen website. So it's www.citizen.org. I think it's /trade, but if you just go to citizen.org, you'll be able to get to the trade pages. In addition, Sierra Club has got a great website on environmental issues related to trade, www.sierraclub.org/trade. Wendy?
Well, I was just going to plug, yeah, the Citizen Trade Campaign is a great site to go to. They have articles on all different aspects of the CAFTA agreement, from agriculture to labor to patents to medicines, the whole nine yards, and from all different sources, not just from one viewpoint.
All right. Well,
do I have a moment just to plug again, calling people's senators?
Unfortunately, I got to cut you off.
Okay, thanks.
So hopefully they got that info earlier. So I want to thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have just been talking with Marina Skomanich of Seattle Audubon and Wendy Dyson of the Community Alliance for Global Justice about CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement.